his dreams whenever he closed his eyes to sleep. Alone in the tent, as the golden scarlet rays of the setting sun shone through the open flap, John Cunnington shrugged off his wolfskin cloak, slipped his mail shirt off over his head, settled on a camp stool, and peeled the glove from his right hand. The nail on his middle finger had turned as black as jet, he saw, and the grey had crept up almost to the first knuckle. The tip of his ring finger had begun to darken too, and when he touched it with the point of his dagger, he felt nothing. Death, he knew, but slow. I still have time. A year, 2 years, five. Some stone men live for 10. Time enough to cross the sea, to see Griffin's Roost again, to end the usurper's line for good and all, and put Rhaegar's son upon the Iron Throne. Then Lord John Cunnington could die content. The Windblown. The word passed through the camp like a hot wind. She is coming. Her host is on the march. She is racing south to Yunkai to put the city to the torch and its people to the sword, and we are going north to meet her. Frog had it from Dick Straw, who had it from Old Bill Bone, who had it from a Pentoshi named Miriam Maracus, who had a cousin who served as cupbearer to the Tattered Prince. Cos heard it in a command tent, from Keiko's own lips, Dick Straw insisted. We'll march before the day's out, see if we don't. That much proved true. The command came down from the Tattered Prince, through his captains and his sergeants. Strike the tents, load the mules, saddle the horses. We march for Yunkai at the break of day. Not that them Yunkish bastards will be wanting us inside their yellow city, sniffing round their daughters, predicted back the squint-eyed Mirish bowman, whose name meant beans. We'll get provisions in Yunkai, maybe fresh horses, and then it will be on to Meereen to dance with a dragon queen. So hop quick, Frog, and put a nice edge on your master's sword. Might be he'll need it soon. In Dawn, Quentin Martell had been a prince, in Valantis a merchant's man, but on the shores of Slaver's Bay he was only Frog, squire to the big bold Dornish knight the sellswords called Greenguts. The men of the Windblown used what names they would, and changed them at a whim. They fastened Frog on him, because he hopped so fast when the big man shouted a command. Even the commander of the Windblown kept his true name to himself. Some free companies had been born during the century of blood and chaos that had followed the doom of Valyria. Others had been formed yesterday and would be gone upon the morrow. The Windblown went back 30 years, and had but one commander, the soft-spoken, sad-eyed Pentoshi nobleman, called the Tattered Prince. His hair and mail were silver-grey, but his ragged cloak was made of twists of cloth of many colours, blue and grey and purple, red and gold and green, magenta and vermilion and cerulean, all faded by the sun. When the Tattered Prince was 23, as Dick Straw told the story, the magisters of Pentos had chosen him to be their new prince, hours after beheading their old prince. Instead, he'd buckled on a sword, mounted his favourite horse, and fled to the disputed lands, never to return. He had ridden with the Second Sons, the Iron Shields, and the Maiden's Men, then joined with 5 brothers-in-arms to form the Windblown. Of those 6 founders, only he survived. Frog had no notion whether any of that was true. Since signing into the Windblown in Valantis, he had seen the Tattered Prince only at a distance. The Dornish men were new hands, raw recruits, arrow fodder, 3 amongst 2,000. Their commander kept more elevated company. "I am not a squire," Quentin had protested, when Gerald Drinkwater, known here as Dornish Geralt, to distinguish him from Geralt Redback and Black Geralt, and sometimes as Drink, since the big man had slipped and called him that, suggested the ruse. I earned my spurs in Dorn. I am as much a knight as you are. But Gareth had the right of it. He and Arch were here to protect Quentin, and that meant keeping him by the big man's side. Arch is the best fighter of the three of us, Drinkwater had pointed out, but only you can hope to wed the Dragon Queen. Wed her, or fight her either way, I will face her soon. The more Quentin heard of Daenerys Targaryen, the more he feared that meeting. The Yunkai claimed that she fed her dragons on human flesh, and bathed in the blood of virgins to keep her skin smooth and supple. Beans laughed at that, but relished the tales of the Silver Queen's promiscuity. One of her captains comes of a line where the men have foot-long members, he told them, but even he's not big enough for her. She'd rolled with a Dothraki and grew accustomed to being fucked by stallions, so now no man can fill her. And Books, the clever Volantine swordsman, who always seemed to have his nose poked in some crumbly scroll, thought the Dragon Queen both murderous and mad.
Her cow killed her brother to make her queen. Then she killed her cow to make herself Khaleesi. She practices blood sacrifice, lies as easily as she breathes, turns against her own on a whim. She's broken truces, tortured envoys. Her father was mad, too. It runs in the blood.
It runs in the blood. King Aerys II had been mad. All of Westeros knew that. He had exiled two of his hands and burnt a third. If Daenerys is as murderous as her father, must I still marry her? Prince Doran had never spoken of that possibility. Frog would be glad to put Astabor behind him. The Red City was the closest thing to hell he ever hoped to know. The Yunkai had sealed the broken gates to keep the dead and dying inside the city. But the sights that he had seen riding down those red brick streets would haunt Quentin Martell forever. A river choked with corpses, the priestess in her torn robes impaled upon a stake and attended by a cloud of glistening green flies. Dying men staggering through the streets, bloody and befouled, children fighting over half-cooked puppies, the last free king of Astapor screaming naked in the pit as he was set upon by a score of starving dogs, and fires, fires everywhere. He could close his eyes and see them still, flames whirling from brick pyramids larger than any castle he'd ever seen, plumes of greasy smoke coiling upward like great black snakes. When the wind blew from the south, the air smelled of smoke even here, 3 miles from the city. Behind its crumbling red brick walls, Astapor was still a smoulder, though by now most of the great fires had burned out. Ashes floated lazily on the breeze like fat grey snowflakes. It would be good to go. The big man agreed.
"Past time," he said,
when Frog found him dicing with Beans and Books and old Bill Bone, and losing yet again. The sellswords loved Green Guts, who bet as fearlessly as he fought, but with far less success.
"I want my armor, Frog. Did you scrub that blood off my mail?"
"Aye, sir." Green Guts's mail was old and heavy, patched and patched again, much worn. The same was true of his helm, his gorget, greaves, and gauntlets, and the rest of his mismatched plate. Frog's kit was only slightly better, and Sir Gareth's was notably worse.
"Company steel," the armourer had called it.
Quentin had not asked how many other men had worn it before him, how many men had died in it. They had abandoned their own fine armour in Valentus, along with their gold and their true names. Wealthy knights from houses old in honour did not cross the narrow sea to sell their swords, unless exiled for some infamy. "I'd sooner pose as poor than evil," Quentin had declared, when Gareth had explained his ruse to them. It took the windblown less than an hour to strike their camp. "And now we ride," the tattered prince proclaimed from his huge grey warhorse, in a classic High Valyrian that was the closest thing they had to a company tongue. His stallion's sputtered hindquarters were covered with ragged strips of cloth torn from the surcoats of men his master had slain. The prince's cloak was sewn together for more of the same. An old man he was, past 60, yet he still sat straight and tall in the high saddle, and his voice was strong enough to carry to every corner of the field.
"Master Paul, was but a taste," he said. "Meereen will be the feast."
And the sellswords sent up a wild cheer. Streamers of pale blue silk fluttered from their lances, whilst fork-tailed blue and white banners flew overhead, the standards of the wind-blown. The three Dornish men cheered with all the rest. Silence would have drawn notice. But as the wind-blown rode north along the coast road, close behind Blodbeard and the company of the cat, Frog fell in beside Dornish Geralt. "Soon," he said, in the common tongue of Westeros. There were other Westerosi in the company, but not many, and not near.
"We need to do it soon."
"Not here,"
warned Garrus, with a mummer's empty smile.
"We'll speak of this tonight, when we make camp."
It was 100 leagues from Astabor to Yunkai, by the old Gascari coast road, and another 50 from Yunkai to Meereen. The free companies, well mounted, could reach Yunkai in 6 days of hard riding, or 8 at a more leisurely pace. The legions from Olgis would take half again as long, marching afoot, and the Yunkai and their slave soldiers,
"with their generals, it's a wonder they don't march into the sea," Bean said.
The Yunkai did not lack for commanders. An old hero named Yerkazo Yunsak had the supreme command, though the men of the Windblown glimpsed him only at a distance, coming and going in a palanquin so huge it required 40 slaves to carry it. They could not help but see his underlings, however. The Yunkish lordlings scuttled everywhere, like roaches. Half of them seemed to be named Gazdan, Grazdan, Mazdan, or Gaznak. Telling one Gascari name from another was an art few of the Windblown had mastered, so they gave them mocking styles of their own devising. Foremost amongst them was the Yellow Whale, an obscenely fat man who always wore yellow silk tokars with golden fringes. Too heavy even to stand unassisted, he could not hold his water, so he always smelled of piss, a stench so sharp that even heavy perfumes could not conceal it. But he was said to be the richest man in Yunkai, and he had a passion for grotesques. His slaves included a boy with the legs and hooves of a goat, a bearded woman, a two-headed monster for Mantares, and a hermaphrodite who warmed his bed at night.
"Cock and Connie both," Dick Straw told them. "The Whale used to own a giant, too, liked to watch him fuck his slave girls. Then he died. I hear the Whale would give a sack of gold for a new one."
Then there was a girl general who rode about on a white horse with a red mane and commanded 100 strapping slave soldiers that she had bred and trained herself, all of them young, lean, rippling with muscle, and naked but for breech clouts, yellow cloaks, and long bronze shields with erotic inlays. Their mistress could not have been more than 16, and fancied herself Yunkai's own Daenerys Targaryen. The little pigeon was not quite a dwarf, but he might have passed for one in a bad light. Yet he strutted about as if he were a giant, with his plump little legs spread wide and his plump little chest puffed out. His soldiers were the tallest that any of the Windblown had ever seen. The shortest stood 7 feet tall, the tallest close to 8. All were long-faced and long-legged, and the stilts built into the legs of their ornate armor made them longer still. Pink enamel scales covered their torsos. On their heads were perched elongated helms, complete with pointed steel beaks and crests of bobbing pink feathers. Each man wore a long, curved sword upon his hip, and each clasped a spear as tall as he was, with a leaf-shaped blade at either end.
"The little pigeon breeds them," Dick Straw informed them. He buys tall slaves from all over the world, mates the men to the women, and keeps the tallest offspring for the errands. One day, he hopes to be able to dispense with the stilts.
A few sessions on the wreck might speed along the process, suggested the big man.
Gareth Drinkwater laughed.
A fearsome lot. Nothing scares me worse than stilt walkers in pink scales and feathers. If one was after me, I'd laugh so hard my bladder might let go.
Some say that errands are majestic, said old Bill Bone.
If your king eats frogs while standing on one leg.
Errands or craven, the big man put in.
One time me and Drink and Cletus were hunting, and we came on these herrings wading in the shallows, feasting on tadpoles and small fish. They made a pretty sight, aye, but then a hawk passed overhead, and they all took to the wing, like they'd seen a dragon. Kicked up so much wind, it blew me off me horse, but Cletus knocked an arrow to his string and brought one down. Tasted like duck, but not so greasy.
Even the little pigeon and his herons paled beside the folly of the brothers the sellswords called the Clanker Lords. The last time the slave soldiers of Yonkai had faced the Dragon Queens unsullied, they'd broken and run. The Clanker Lords had devised a stratagem to prevent that. They chained their troops together in groups of 10, wrist to wrist and ankle to ankle.
None of the poor bastards can run unless they all run,
Dick Straw explained, laughing.
And if they do all run, they won't run very fast.
They don't fucking march very fast either, observed Beans. You can hear them clanking 10 leagues off.
There were more, near as mad or worse. Lord Wobblecheeks, the Drunken Conqueror, the Beastmaster, Pudding Face, the Rabbit, the Charioteer, the Perfumed Hero. Some had 20 soldiers, some 200, or 2,000, all slaves they had trained and equipped themselves. Everyone was wealthy, everyone was arrogant, and everyone was a captain and commander, answerable to no one but Yerkes Zeryunsek, disdainful of mere sellswords, and prone to squabbles over precedents that were as endless as they were incomprehensible. In the time it took the Windblown to ride 3 miles, the Yunkai had fallen 2.5 miles behind.
A pack of stinking yellow fools, Beans complained. They still ain't managed to puzzle out why the Stone Crows and the Second Stones went over to the Dragon Queen.
For gold, they believe, said Books. Why do you think they're paying us so well?
Gold is sweet, but life is sweeter, said Beans. We were dancing with cripples at Astapor. Do you want to face real unsolid with that lot on your side?
We fought the unsolid at Astapor, the big man said.
I said real unsolid, hacking off some boy's stones with a butcher's cleaver and handing him a pointy hat. Don't make him unsolid. That Dragon Queen's got the real item, the kind that don't break and run when you fart in their general direction.
Them and dragons, too.
Dick Straw glanced up at the sky, as if he thought the mere mention of dragons might be enough to bring them down upon the company.
Keep your sword sharp, boys. We'll have us a real fight soon.
A real fight, thought Frog.
The words stuck in his craw. The fight beneath the walls of Astapor had seemed real enough to him, though he knew the sellswords felt otherwise.
That was butchery, not battle, the warrior bard Denzo Dan had been heard to declare afterwards.
Denzo was a captain and veteran of 100 battles. Frog's experience was limited to practice yard and tourney ground, so he did not think it was his place to dispute the verdict of such a seasoned warrior.
It seemed like a battle when it first began, though.
He remembered how his guts had clenched when he was kicked awake at dawn with a big man looming over him.
"In your armor, slug a bit," he boomed. "The butcher's coming out to give us battle. Up, unless you mean to be his meat.
The Butcher King is dead, Frog had protested sleepily. That was a story all of them had heard, as they scrambled from the ships that had brought them from old Volantis. A second King Cleon had taken the crown and died in turn, supposedly, and now the Astapori were ruled by a whore and a mad barber whose followers were fighting with each other to control the city.
"Maybe they lied," the big man had replied, "or else this is some other butcher. Might be the first one to come back screaming from his tomb to kill some youngish men. Makes no bloody matter, Frog. Get your armor on."
The tent slept ten, and all of them had been on their feet by then, wriggling into breeches and boots, sliding long coats of ringmail down onto their shoulders, buckling breastplates, tightening the straps on greaves or van braces, grabbing for helms and shields and sword belts. Garrus, quick as ever, was the first one fully clad, Arch close behind him. Together they helped Quentin don his own harness. 300 yards away, Astapor's new Unsolid had been pouring through their gates and forming up in ranks beneath their city's crumbling red brick walls, dawn-like glinting off their spiked bronze helmets and the points of their long spears. The three Dornishmen spilled from the tent together to join the fighters sprinting for the horse lines. Battle! Quentin had trained with spear and sword and shield since he was old enough to walk, but that meant nothing now. "Warrior, make me brave," Frog had prayed as drums beat in the distance. Boom, 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 boom. The big man pointed out the Butcher King to him, sitting stiff and tall, upon an armored horse in a suit of copper scale that flashed brilliantly in the morning sun. He remembered Garrus sidling up close just before the fight began. "Stay close to Arch, whatever happens. Remember, you are the only one of us who can get the girl." By then the Astapori were advancing. Dead or alive, the Butcher King still took the wise masters unawares. The youngish men were still running about in fluttering tokars, trying to get their half-trained slave soldiers into some semblance of order, as Unsolid spears came crashing through their siege lines. If not for their allies and their despised hirelings, they might well have been overwhelmed. But the Windblown and the Company of the Cat were a horse in minutes and came thundering down on the Astapori flanks, even as a legion from New Gis pushed through the Yunkish camp from the other side and met the Unsolid spear to spear and shield to shield. The rest was butchery, but this time it was the Butcher King on the wrong end of the cleaver. Kago was the one who finally cut him down, fighting through the king's protectors on his monstrous warhorse and opening Cleon the Great from shoulder to hip with one blow of his curved Valyrian arrack. Frog did not see it, but those who did claimed Cleon's copper armor rent like silk, and from within came an awful stench and 100 wriggling grave worms. Cleon had been dead after all. The desperate Astapori had pulled him from his tomb, clapped him into armor, and tied him onto a horse in hopes of giving heart to their Unsolid. Dead Cleon's fall wrote an end to that. The new Unsolid threw down their spears and shields and ran, only to find the gates of Astapor shut behind them. Frog had done his part in the slaughter that followed, riding down the frightened eunuchs with the other Windblown. Hard by the big man's hip he rode, slashing right and left as their wedge went through the Unsolid like a spear point. When they burst through on the other side, the tattered prince had wheeled them round and led them through again. It was only coming back that Frog got a good look at the faces beneath the spiked bronze caps and realized that most were no older than he. "Green boys screaming for their mothers," he thought. But he killed them all the same. By the time he'd left the field, his sword was running red with blood, and his arm was so tired he could hardly lift it.
Yet that was no real fight, he thought. The real fight will be on us soon, and we must be away before it comes, or we'll find ourselves fighting on the wrong side.
That night the Windblown made camp beside the shore of Slaver's Bay. Frog drew the first watch and was sent to guard the horse lines. Garrus met him there just after sundown, as a half-moon shone upon the waters.
"The big man should be here as well," said Quentin.
"He's gone to look up old Bill Bone and lose the rest of his silver," Garrus said. "Leave him out of this. He'll do as we say, though he won't like it much."
No. There was much and more about this Quentin did not like himself. Sailing on an overcrowded ship, tossed by wind and sea, eating hard bread, crawling with weevils, and drinking black tar rum to sweet oblivion, sleeping on piles of mouldy straw with a stench of strangers in his nostrils. All that he had expected when he made his mark on that scrap of parchment in Volantis, pledging the tattered prince his sword and service for a year. Those were hardships to be endured, the stuff of all adventures. But what must come next was plain betrayal. The Yunkai had brought them from old Volantis to fight for the Yellow City, but now the Dornishmen meant to turn their cloaks and go over to the other side. That meant abandoning their new brothers-in-arms as well. The Windblown were not the sort of companions Quentin would have chosen, but he had crossed the sea with them, shared their meat and mead, fought beside them, traded tales with those few whose talk he understood. And if all his tales were lies, well, that was a cost of passage to Meereen. "It is not what you call honourable," Garrus had warned them back at the merchant's house. "Daenerys may be halfway to Yunkai by now, with an army at her back," Quentin said as they walked amongst the horses. "She may be," Garrus said, "but she's not. We've heard such talk before. The Astapori were convinced Daenerys was coming south with her dragons to break the siege. She didn't come then, and she's not coming now." "We can't know that, not for certain. We need to steal away before we end up fighting the woman I was sent to woo." "Wait till Yunkai," Garrus gestured at the hills. "These lands belong to the Yunkai. No one is like to want to feed or shelter three deserters. North of Yunkai, that's no man's land." He was not wrong. Even so, Quentin felt uneasy. "The big man's made too many friends. He knows the plan was always to steal off and make our way to Daenerys, but he's not going to feel good about abandoning men he's fought with. If we wait too long, it's going to feel as if we're deserting them on the eve of battle. He will never do that. You know him as well as I do."
"It's desertion, whenever we do it," argued Garrus. "And the tattered prince takes a dim view of deserters. He'll send hunters after us, and seven savers if they catch us. If we're lucky, they'll just chop off a foot to make sure we never run again. If we're unlucky, they'll give us to Pretty Maris."
That last gave Quentin pause. Pretty Maris frightened him. A Westerosi woman, but taller than he was, just a thumb under 6 feet. After 20 years amongst the free companies, there was nothing pretty about her, inside or out. Garrus took him by the arm. "Wait a few more days, that's all. We have crossed half the world. Be patient for a few more leagues. Somewhere north of Yunkai, our chance will come." "If you see," said Frog doubtfully. But for once the guards were listening, and their chance came much sooner than that. It was 2 days later. Hugh Hungerford reined up by their cook fire and said,
"Dornish, you're wanted in the command tent."
"Which one of us?" asked Garrus. "We're all Dornish."
"All of you, then."
Sar and Saturnine, with a maimed hand, Hungerford had been company paymaster for a time, until the tattered prince had caught him stealing from the coffers and removed three of his fingers. Now he was just a sergeant.
What could this be?
Up to now, Frog had no notion that their commander knew he was alive. Hungerford had already ridden off, however.
so there was no time for questions. All they could do was gather up the big man and report as ordered. "Admit to nothing and be prepared to fight," Quentin told his friends.
"I'm always prepared to fight," said the big man.
The great grey sailcloth pavilion that the tattered prince liked to call his canvas castle was crowded when the Dornishmen arrived. It took Quentin only a moment to realize that most of those assembled were from the Seven Kingdoms or boasted Westerosi blood. Exiles, or the sons of exiles. Dixtor claimed there were 70 Westerosi in the company. A good third of those were here, including Dick himself, Hugh Hungerford, Pretty Maris, and golden-haired Lewis Leinster, the company's best archer. Denzo Dahn was there as well, with Kago huge beside him. Kago Corpse Killer, the men were calling him now, though not to his face. He was quick to anger, and that curved black sword of his was as nasty as its owner. There were hundreds of Valyrian longswords in the world, but only a handful of Valyrian Araks. Neither Kago nor Dahn was Westerosi, but both were captains, and stood high in the tattered prince's regard. "His right arm and his left. Something major is afoot." It was the tattered prince himself who did the speaking. "Orders have come down from Yarkas," he said. "What Astaporia still survive have come creeping from their hidey-holes, it seems. There's nothing left in Astapor but corpses. So they're pouring out into the countryside, hundreds of them, maybe thousands, all starved and sick. The Yunkai don't want them near their yellow city. We've been commanded to hunt them down and turn them, drive them back to Astapor or north to Meereen. If the Dragon Queen wants to take them in, she's welcome to them. Half of them have the bloody flux, and even the healthy ones are mouths to feed."
"Yunkai is closer than Meereen," Hugh Hungerford objected.
"What if they won't turn, my lord?"
"That's why you have swords and lances, Hugh, though bows might serve you better. Stay well away from those who show signs of the flux. I'm sending half our strength into the hills. 50 patrols, 20 riders each. Bloodbeard's got the same orders, so the cats will be in the field as well." A look passed between the men, and a few muttered under their breath. Though the Windblown and the Company of the Cat were both under contract to Yunkai, a year ago in their disputed lands they had been on opposite sides of the battle lines, and bad blood still lingered. Bloodbeard, the savage commander of the cats, was a roaring giant with a ferocious appetite for slaughter, who made no secret of his disdain for old greybeards in rags. Dick Straw cleared his throat.
"Begging your pardon, but we're all Seven Kingdoms born here. My lord never broke up the company by blood or tongue before. Why send us lot together?"
"A fair question. You're to ride east, deep into the hills, then swing wide about Yunkai, making for Meereen. Should you come on any Astapori, drive them north or kill them. But no, that is not the purpose of your mission. Beyond the Yellow City, you're like to come up against the Dragon Queen's patrols, Second Sons or Stormcrows. Either will serve. Go over to them."
"Go over to them," said the bastard knight, Sir Orson Stone. "You'd have us turn our cloaks."
"I would," said the tattered prince. Quentin Martell almost laughed aloud. "Ah, the gods are mad." The Westerosi shifted uneasily. Some stared into their wine cups, as if they hoped to find some wisdom there. Hugh Hungerford frowned.
"You think Queen Daenerys will take us in?"
"I do."
"But if she does, what then? Are we spies, assassins, envoys? Are you thinking to change sides?"
Kago scowled.
"That is for the prince to decide, Hungerford. Your part is to do as you're told."
"Always."
Hungerford raised his two-fingered hand.
"Let us be frank," said Denzo Dahn, the warrior bard. "The Yunkai do not inspire confidence. Whatever the outcome of this war, the Windblown should share in the spoils of victory. Our prince is wise to keep all roads open.
Meris will command you, said the tattered prince. She knows my mind in this, and Daenerys Targaryen may be more accepting of another woman.
Quentin glanced back to pretty Maris. When her cold, dead eyes met his, he felt a shiver.
I do not like this.
Dick Straw still had doubts as well.
The girl would be a fool to trust us, even with Maris. Especially with Maris. Hell, I don't trust Maris, and I've fought her a few times.
He grinned, but no one laughed. Least of all, pretty Maris.
I think you are mistaken, Dick, the tattered prince said. You are all Westerosi, friends from home. You speak her tongue, worship her gods. As for motive, all of you have suffered wrongs at my hands. Dick, I've whipped you more than any man in the company, and you have the back to prove it. Hugh lost 3 fingers to my discipline. Maris was raped half round the company. Not this company, true, but we need not mention that. Will of the Woods, well, you're just filth. Sir Orson blames me for dispatching his brother to the Sorrows, and Sir Lucifer is still seething about that slave girl Kago took from him.
He could have given her back when he'd had her, Lucifer long complained. He had no cause to kill her. She was ugly, said Kago. That's cause enough.
The tattered prince went on as if no one had spoken.
Weber, you nurse claims to lands lost in Westeros. Lannister, I killed that boy you were so fond of. You Dornish Three, you think we lied to you. The plunder from Astapor was much less than you were promised in Volantis, and I took the lion's share of it.
The last part is true, Sir Orson said.
The best losers always have some seed of truth, said the tattered prince. Every one of you has ample reason for wanting to abandon me, and Daenerys Targaryen knows that sellswords are a fickle lot. Her own second sons and Stormcrows took Yunkish gold, but did not hesitate to join her when the tide of battle began to flow her way.
When should we leave? Asked Lewis Lannister.
At once. Be wary of the cats and any long lancers you may encounter. No one will know your defection is a ruse but those of us in this tent. Turn your tiles too soon, and you will be maimed as deserters or disemboweled as turncloaks. The 3 Dornishmen were silent as they left the command tent.
20 riders, all speaking the common tongue, thought Quentin. Whispering has just gotten a deal more dangerous.
The big man slapped him hard across the back.
So, this is sweet, Frog. A dragon hunt.
The Wayward Bride. Asher Greyjoy was seated in Gorbert Glover's long hall, drinking Gorbert Glover's wine, when Gorbert Glover's maester brought the letter to her.
My lady,
the maester's voice was anxious, as it always was when he spoke to her.
A bird from Barrowton.
He thrust the parchment at her, as if he could not wait to be rid of it. It was tightly rolled and sealed with a button of hard pink wax.
Barrowton? Asher tried to recall who ruled in Barrowton. Some northern lord, no friend of mine.
And that seal, the Boltons of the Dreadfort, went into battle beneath pink banners spattered with little drops of blood. It only stood to reason that they would use pink sealing wax as well.
"This is poison that I hold," she thought. "I ought to burn it."
Instead, she cracked the seal. A scrap of leather fluttered down into her lap. When she read the dry brown words, her black mood grew blacker still.
"Dark wings, dark words."
The ravens never brought glad tidings. The last message sent to Deepwood had been from Stannis Baratheon, demanding homage. This was worse.
The Northmen have taken Moat Cailin.
The bastard of Bolton,
asked Carl beside her. "Ramsay Bolton, Lord of Winterfell," he signs himself. "But there are other names as well." Lady Dustin, Lady Serwyn, and four Risewells had appended their own signatures beneath his. Beside them was drawn a crude giant, the mark of some umber. Those were done in maester's ink, made of soot and coal tar, but the message above was scrawled in brown, in a huge spiky hand. It spoke of the fall of Moat Cailin, of the triumphant return of the Warden of the North to his domains, of a marriage soon to be made. The first words were, "I write this letter in the blood of Ironmen." The last, "I send you each a piece of prince. Linger in my lands and share his fate." Asher had believed her little brother dead. Better dead than this. The scrap of skin had fallen into her lap. She held it to the candle and watched the smoke curl up, until the last of it had been consumed and the flame was licking at her fingers. Gorbert Glover's maester hovered expectantly at her elbow. "There will be no answer," she informed him. "May I share these tidings with Lady Sibel?" "If it please you." Whether Sibel Glover would find any joy in the fall of Moat Cailin, Asher could not say. Lady Sibel all but lived in her godswood, praying for her children and her husband's safe return. "Another prayer late to go unanswered. Her heart tree is as deaf and blind as our drowned god." Robert Glover and his brother Gorbert had ridden south with the young wolf. If the tales they had heard of the Red Wedding were even half true, they were not like to ride north again. "Her children are alive, at least, and that is thanks to me." Asher had left them at Ten Towers, in the care of her aunts. Lady Sibel's infant daughter was still on the breast, and she had judged the girl too delicate to expose to the rigours of another stormy crossing. Asher shoved the letter into the maester's hands. "Here, let her find some solace here, if she can. You have my leave to go." The maester inclined his head and departed. After he was gone, Triss Butley turned to Asher. "If Moat Cailin has fallen, Torrens Square will soon follow. Then it will be our turn. Not for a while yet, the cleft jaw will make them bleed." Torrens Square was not a ruin like Moat Cailin, and Dagmar was iron to the bone. He would die before he yield. "If my father still lived, Moat Cailin would never have fallen." Balin Greyjoy had known that the moat was the key to holding the north. Euron knew that as well. He simply did not care. No more than he cared what happened to Deepwood Mott or Torrens Square. "Euron has no interest in Balin's conquest. My nuncle's off chasing dragons." The crow's eye had summoned all the strength of the Iron Isles to Old Wick, and sailed out into the deepness of the sunset sea, with his brother Victorian following behind like a whipped cur. There was no one left on Pike to appeal to, save for her own lord husband. "We stand alone." "Dagmar will smash them," insisted Crumb, who had never met a woman he had loved half so much as battle. "They are only wolves." "The wolves are all slain." Asher picked at the pink wax with her thumbnail. "These are the skinners who slew them." "We should go to Torrens Square and join the fight," urged Quentin Greyjoy, a distant cousin and captain of the Salty Wench. "Aye," said Dagon Greyjoy, a cousin still more distant. Dagon the Drunkard, men called him, but drunk or sober he loved to fight. "Why should the cleft jaw have all the glory for himself?" Two of Gorbert Glover's serving men brought forth the roast, but that strip of skin had taken Asher's appetite. "My men have given up all hope of victory," she realized glumly. "All they look for now is a good death." The wolves would give them that, she had no doubt. "Soon or late, they will come to take this castle back." The sun was sinking behind the tall pines of the Wolfswood as Asher climbed the wooden steps to the bedchamber that had once been Gorbert Glover's.
She had drunk too much wine, and her head was pounding. Asher Greyjoy loved her men, captains and crew alike, but half of them were fools. Brave fools, but fools nonetheless. Go to the cleft jaw, yes, as if we could. Between Deepwood and Dagmar lay long leagues, rugged hills, thick woods, wild rivers, and more Northmen than she cared to contemplate. Asher had 4 longships and not quite 200 men, including Christopher Butley, who could not be relied on. For all his talk of love, she could not imagine Triss rushing off to Torren Square to die with Dagmar Cleftjaw. Carl followed her up to Gorbert Glover's bedchamber. "Get out," she told him. "I want to be alone." "What you want is me." He tried to kiss her. Asher pushed him away. "Touch me again and I'll—" "What?" He drew his dagger. "Undress yourself, girl. Fuck yourself, you beardless boy. I'd sooner fuck you." One quick slash unlaced her jerkin. Asher reached for her axe, but Carl dropped his knife and caught her wrist, twisting back her arm until the weapon fell from her fingers. He pushed her back onto Glover's bed, kissed her hard, and tore off her tunic to let her breasts spill out. When she tried to knee him in the groin, he twisted away and forced her legs apart with his knees. "I'll have you now." "Do it," she spat, "and I'll kill you in your sleep." She was sopping wet when he entered her. "Damn you," she said. "Damn you, damn you, damn you." He sucked her nipples till she cried out, half in pain and half in pleasure. Her cunt became the world. She forgot Moat Cailin and Ramsay Bolton and his little piece of skin, forgot the King's Moot, forgot her failure, forgot her exile and her enemies and her husband. Only his hands mattered, only his mouth, only his arms around her, his cock inside her. He fucked her till she screamed, and then again until she wept, before he finally spent his seed inside her womb. "I am a woman wed," she reminded him afterward. "You've despoiled me, you beardless boy. My lord husband will cut your balls off and put you in a dress." Carl rolled off her. "If he can get out of his chair." The room was cold. Asher rose from Gorbert Glover's bed and took off her torn clothes. The jerkin would need fresh laces, but her tunic was ruined. "I never liked it anyway." She tossed it on the flames. The rest she left in a puddle by the bed. Her breasts were sore, and Carl's seed was trickling down her thigh. She would need to brew some moon tea, or risk bringing another kraken into the world. "What does it matter? My father's dead, my mother's dying, my brother's being flayed, and there's naught that I can do about any of it. And I'm married, wedded and bedded, though not by the same man." When she slipped back beneath the furs, Carl was asleep. "Now your life is mine. Where did I put my dagger?" Asher pressed herself against his back and slid her arms about him. On the Isles he was known as Carl the Maid, in part to distinguish him from Carl Shepherd. Queer Carl Kenning, Carl Quickaxe, and Carl the Thrall. But more for his smooth cheeks. When Asher had first met him, Carl had been trying to raise a beard. "Peach fuzz," she had called it, laughing. Carl confessed that he had never seen a peach, so she told him he must join her on her next voyage south. It had still been summer then. Robert sat the Iron Throne, Balin brooded on the Seastone Chair, and the 7 kingdoms were at peace. Asher sailed the Black Wind down the coast, trading. They called at Fair Isle and Lannisport, and a score of smaller ports before reaching the Arbor, where the peaches were always huge and sweet. "You see," she said, the first time she'd held one up against Carl's cheek. When she made him try a bite, the juice ran down his chin, and she had to kiss it clean. That night they'd spent devouring peaches and each other, and by the time daylight returned, Asher was sated and sticky and as happy as she'd ever been.
Was that 6 years ago, or seven? Summer was a fading memory, and it had been 3 years since Asher last enjoyed a peach. She still enjoyed Carl, though. The captains and the kings might not have wanted her, but he did. Asher had known other lovers. Some shared her bed for half a year, some for half a night. Carl pleased her more than all the rest together. He might shave but once a fortnight, but a shaggy beard does not make a man. She liked the feel of his smooth, soft skin beneath her fingers. She liked the way his long, straight hair brushed against his shoulders. She liked the way he kissed. She liked how he grinned when she brushed her thumbs across his nipples. The hair between his legs was a darker shade of sand than the hair in his head, but fine as down compared to the coarse black bush around her own sex. She liked that, too. He had a swimmer's body, long and lean, with not a scar upon him. A shy smile, strong arms, clever fingers, and two sure swords. What more could any woman want? She would have married Carl, and gladly, but she was Lord Balin's daughter, and he was common-born, the grandson of a thrall. Too low-born for me to wed, but not too low for me to suck his cock. Drunk, smiling, she crawled beneath the furs and took him in her mouth. Carl stirred in his sleep, and after a moment he began to stiffen. By the time she had him hard again, he was awake, and she was wet. Asher draped the furs across her bare shoulders and mounted him, drawing him so deep inside her that she could not tell who had the cock and who the cunt. This time the two of them reached their peak together. "My sweet lady," he murmured after, in a voice still thick with sleep, "my sweet queen." "No," Asher thought, "I am no queen, nor shall I ever be. Go back to sleep." She kissed his cheek, padded across Gorbert Glover's bedchamber, and threw the shutters open. The moon was almost full, the night so clear that she could see the mountains, their peaks crowned with snow. "Cold and bleak, and inhospitable, but beautiful in the moonlight." Their summits glimmered pale and jagged as a row of sharpened teeth. The foothills and the smaller peaks were lost in shadow. The sea was closer, only 5 leagues north, but Asher could not see it. Too many hills stood in the way. And trees, so many trees. The wolf's wood, the Northmen named the forest. Most nights you could hear the wolves calling to each other through the dark. An ocean of leaves. Would it were an ocean of water? Deepwood might be closer to the sea than Winterfell, but it was still too far for her taste. The air smelled of pines instead of salt. Northeast of those grim grey mountains stood the wall, where Stannis Baratheon had raised his standards. "The enemy of my enemy is my friend," men said, but the other side of that coin was, "The enemy of my friend is my enemy." The Ironborn were the enemies of the northern lords this Baratheon pretender needed desperately. "I could offer him my fair young body," she thought, pushing a strand of hair from her eyes. But Stannis was wed, and so was she, and he and the Ironborn were old foes. During her father's first rebellion, Stannis had smashed the Iron Fleet off Fair Isle and subdued Great Wick in his brother's name. Deepwood's mossy walls enclosed a wide, rounded hill with a flattened top, crowned by a cavernous long hall with a watchtower at one end, rising 50 feet above the hill. Beneath the hill was the bailey, with its stables, paddock, smithy, well, and sheepfold, defended by a deep ditch, a sloping earthen dike, and a palisade of logs. The outer defences made an oval, following the contours of the land. There were two gates, each protected by a pair of square wooden towers, and wall walks around the perimeter. On the south side of the castle, moss grew thick upon the palisade and crept halfway up the towers. To east and west were empty fields. Oats and barley had been growing there when Asher took the castle, only to be crushed underfoot during her attack.
A series of hard frosts had killed the crops they'd planted afterwards, leaving only mud and ash and wilted, rotting stalks. It was an old castle, but not a strong one. She had taken it from the Glovers, and the bastard of Bolton would take it from her. He would not flay her, though. Asher Greyjoy did not intend to be taken alive. She would die as she had lived, with an axe in her hand and a laugh upon her lips. Her lord father had given her 30 longships to capture Deepwood. 4 remained, counting her own Black Wind, and one of those belonged to Triss Botley, who had joined her when all her other men were fleeing. No, that is not just. They sailed home to do homage to their king. If anyone fled, it was me. The memory still shamed her. Go, the reader urged, as the captains were bearing her Uncle Urin down Nagas Hill to don his driftwood crown. Said the raven to the crow, "Come with me, I need ye to raise the men of Harlaw." Back then she meant to fight. "The men of Harlaw are here, the ones who count. Some were shouting Urin's name. I will not set Harlaw against Harlaw. Urin's mad and dangerous. That hellhorn, I heard it. Go, Asher. Once Urin has been crowned, he'll look for you. You dare not let his eye fall upon you. If I stand with my other uncles, you will die outcasts, with every hand against you. When you put your name before the captains, you submitted yourself to their judgment. You cannot go against that judgment now. Only once has the choice of a king's moot been overthrown. Read Herrick." Only Roderick the Reader would talk of some old book, whilst their lives were balanced on a sword's edge. "If you are saying, so am I," she told him stubbornly. "Don't be a fool. Urin shows the world his smiling eye tonight, but come the morrow, Asher, you are Balin's daughter, and your claim is stronger than his own. So long as you draw breath, you remain a danger to him. If you stay, you will be killed, or wed to the Red Oarsman. I don't know which would be worse. Go! You will not have another chance." Asher had landed Black Wind on the far side of the island for just such an eventuality. Old Wick was not large. She could be back aboard her ship before the sun came up, on her way to Harlaw before Urin realized she was missing. Yet she hesitated, until her uncle said, "Do it, for the love you bear me, child. Do not make me watch you die." So she went. To 10 Towers first, to bid farewell to her mother. "It may be a long while before I come again," Asher warned her. Lady Alanis had not understood. "Where is Theon?" she asked. "Where is my baby boy?" Lady Gwynnis only wanted to know when Lord Roderick would return.
"I am 7 years his elder. 10 Towers should be mine."
Asher was still at 10 Towers, taking on provisions, when the tidings of her marriage reached her. "My wayward niece needs taming," the crow's eye was reported to have said, "and I know the man to tame her." He had married her to Eric Ironmaker, and named the Anvil Breaker to rule the Iron Islands whilst he was chasing dragons. Eric had been a great man in his day, a fearless reaver who could boast of having sailed with her grandsire's grandsire, that same Dagon Greyjoy whom Dagon the Drunkard had been named for. Old women on Fair Isle still frightened their grandchildren with tales of Lord Dagon and his men. "I wounded Eric's pride at the King's Moot," Asher reflected. "He's not like to forget that." She had to pay her nuncle his just due. With one stroke, Urin had turned a rival into a supporter, secured the Isles in his absence, and removed Asher as a threat. "And enjoyed a good belly laugh, too." Triss Botley said that the crow's eye had used a seal to stand in for her at her wedding. "I hope Eric did not insist on a consummation," she'd said. "I cannot go home," she thought, "but I dare not stay here much longer." The quiet of the woods unnerved her. Asher had spent her life on islands and on ships. The sea was never silent. The sound of the waves washing against a rocky shore was in her blood.